Okay, so let's just jump right in. If you look around our modern world, you see this incredible contradiction. We have this staggering productive capacity. I mean, global wealth is immense, technology is revolutionary.
Right, knowledge is everywhere.
And yet, in the middle of all this abundance, you see chronic insecurity, you see inequality just widening, profound ecological damage, yeah. and preventable health crises for huge numbers of people. It just doesn't add up. Why?
That tension, that paradox, is exactly what the source material we're looking at today zeroes in on. It's called The Money Exception by Dr. Bechara Sahili in ChatGPT 5.2.
Okay.
And the analysis argues that the problem isn't just, you know, bad regulation or a few market failures we can patch up with policy. It's something much, much deeper.
So not a bug, but a feature.
It's a structural flaw, a hidden, an inversion, really, in the moral logic that governs how we even define value and property to begin with.
So this deep dive isn't about, say, debating tax brackets or the minimum wage.
Mm-hmm.
We're going way further down.
We're going to the foundations, the ethical architecture, the actual rules that say who gets to use what and under what conditions. It's like the operating system running underneath the global economy.
Right.
So our mission today is really to trace how that happened, to understand how property was originally justified under these very strict life protective conditions by thinkers like, you know, John Locke.
And how one little move.
One little conceptual move, how we treat money, managed to quietly undo all of those limits.
Yeah.
And that mechanism is what the source calls the money exception.
And that's so important because property rules structure everything before we even get to things like taxes or welfare. They're the starting line.
Exactly.
So if those foundational rules are out of sync with what we actually need for human life, for ecological stability, what happens? That's the big question we're diving into.
It creates a system that is, you know, internally rational, but externally just completely destructive.
Okay, so let's start at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
We tend to think of private property as this absolute right to just accumulate.
Right, full stop.
But the source material takes us back to a really fundamental question. What was property even for in early liberal theory before all this unlimited accumulation became normal?
Well, back in the 17th century, property wasn't seen as this abstract, you know, God-given right. It was a very practical and, frankly, a fragile social permission.
A permission.
Yeah. The world was seen as a common inheritance, the life ground. So taking something for private use had to be justified. It was always constrained by the fact that you were coexisting with others in a finite world, land, water.
Hmm.
That was the shared stuff of life.
And John Locke is the key figure here.
Yeah.
He's the one who really tried to legitimize private claims on that common ground. But he didn't just say, go ahead, take what you want.
Not at all. He built what you could call a meticulous moral fence around it. The three famous Lockean provisos. And these weren't suggestions. They were binding conditions.
Okay. Well, what's the first one?
The first was the labor mixing proviso. The idea was that you could claim something by mixing your labor with it.
Okay. That sounds familiar.
But here's the crucial part. You could only take to the extent that you could meaningfully use what you took. The justification wasn't some abstract claim of ownership. It was tied to the act of labor serving your own life. You harvested a field. You owned what you could eat.
Which leads directly to the second condition, the one that really makes this concrete, the non-waste condition.
Right. Locke was adamant about this. One could only appropriate what one could use before it spoiled.
Before it spoiled.
Yeah. So if you gathered 1,000 apples, but 900 of them rotted before you could use them, they weren't yours. They reverted back to the commons.
So waste wasn't just inefficient.
It was a profound moral violation. It completely severed property from its only justification, which was serving life.
By modern standards, that is incredibly restrictive. It basically ties property to biological time. The spoilage rate of food.
It absolutely does. Yeah. And the third condition was the final check, the sufficiency condition.
Enough and as good left for others.
Exactly. Your appropriation was only legitimate if it didn't deprive other people of their ability to subsist. So if you took so much land that your neighbor couldn't survive, your claim was, by definition, morally broken.
So when you put it all together, Locke's original framework is explicitly, well, it's life conditional.
That's the perfect way to put it.
The constraints aren't just add-ons. They're built into the very definition of the property right itself. It was a self-limiting system designed to secure life for everyone.
And that's the system that got completely overturned.
Okay, so if Locke built this, you know, this perfect ethical fence around property, where did the crack appear? How did we get from that self-limiting system to one that's virtually limitless?
Well, this is where we pivot to what the source calls the small move with enormous consequences.
The introduction of money.
The introduction of money. It enters Locke's argument almost innocently. He presents it as just a social convenience.
Right, a way to trade.
It's a durable, non-perishable medium of exchange. You know, silver, gold. It solves a practical problem. If you're a farmer and you have extra apples, you can trade them for silver, which, unlike the apples, won't spoil.
And that seemingly tiny practical solution is the loophole that breaks the entire ethical fence.
It is the critical step. It's where the moral center of gravity just shifts.
Oh.
So his money, by its very nature, doesn't decay. It's durable. So Locke decided to exempt it from the strict non-waste condition.
Oh.
And that was the first and the most monumental moral exemption.
Hang on. So if the whole moral basis for property was tied to use to preventing waste, and now money is exempt from that rule,
then the moral framework for monetary property basically vanishes.
Right.
Think about it. If my wealth is in apples, I'm physically stopped by spoilage. But the second I can turn those apples into silver, there's no limit. Accumulation becomes, in practice, infinite. The moral rule about having just enough is still on the books, so to speak, but the enforcement mechanism spoilage is gone.
And because you can accumulate in this abstract monetary form, it also kind of obscures the sufficiency condition, doesn't it?
That's the domino effect, absolutely. In a world without money, if you took too much land, your neighbor was right there, visibly suffering.
You could see the harm.
You could see it directly. But money lets you accumulate these vast, abstract claims on land, on labor, on future resources, without ever touching them. The deprivation becomes mediated, it's abstract, it's displaced.
The person working at a factory for pennies is deprived, but not by their neighbor putting up a fence. They're deprived by this huge invisible system of monetary claims.
Precisely. And that silent bypass, that's what the source defines as the money exception. This unique moral exemption given to money that allowed it to sidestep all the life-based rules that were supposed to govern material property.
It turns a simple tool into the new governing standard.
It becomes the runaway standard.
So this shift isn't just about how much someone can own. It feels much bigger. It's like a structural inversion where the means suddenly become the ends.
That's it, exactly. Money moves from being a tool that serves life to being the ultimate standard by which life itself is measured.
And this reversal basically defines our modern political economy.
It does. We go from what the source calls the original logic, which was life-bound life sets the standard, and property has to deliver benefits back to life, to the inverted logic, which is money-bound. Now, money sets the standard, and life is judged by how well it contributes to monetary growth.
You see this everywhere. Take labor, for instance. Originally, labor was about securing your own life.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in this inverted logic, labor is just a cost input, something to be minimized, automated, outsourced.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter what happens to the person doing the labor.
And nature. Look at nature. It goes from being this essential life support system, the common ground for everyone, to just a resource stock or an asset on a spreadsheet.
Yeah.
So suddenly, destroying an ecosystem becomes perfectly acceptable if and only if the profit calculation works out in the short term. The monetary value trumps the biological necessity.
This is where the source brings in the philosopher John McMurtry's work to really formalize this difference, to map it out.
Right. It's a diagnostic tool. Instead of just good or bad, it looks at the flow of value. You have the life value sequence versus the money value sequence.
Okay, break those down.
Think of them as two different operating systems. The life sequence is simple. Value flows from life, you know, needs, health, capabilities, to means like labor or money. And then critically, it has to return back to life to enhance it.
So money is just a tool in the middle.
Strictly instrumental. In the money sequence, which is enabled by that money exception, the whole flow reverses.
So it's money to means.
To more money, exactly. Money, right arrow, means right arrow, money. You start with money, you use life and resources as inputs, and the only goal is to end up with more money.
And things like health, education, a stable climate.
They become optional. They're externalized costs. They only matter if they contribute to the monetary return. It creates this self-reinforcing circuit, a bypass loop, that can operate completely independently of what humans or the planet actually need.
That diagnostic map is the real aha moment for me.
Yeah.
Because it explains why so many of our political reforms just seem to fail.
Yes.
If the whole system is running on the money sequence, and we try to introduce a life protective policy, like, say, a huge public health program,
it has to justify itself using the logic of the system it's trying to fix.
Right. The life sequence goal making people healthier gets shot down as too costly or inefficient because it's being judged by the money sequence's standard of profit.
The logic is completely circular. The final judge is always money, not life. And that's why things like ecological collapse and chronic insecurity, they aren't accidents. They are the logical, predictable outcomes of a money-governed value system.
So once this money sequence gets locked in, what are the ripple effects? How does it change our institutions?
Well, the consequences just propagate everywhere. The role of the state, for example, quietly shifts. It moves away from securing the conditions for life, which was the original Lockean idea,
right,
to primarily protecting abstract property and enforcing monetary claims. That becomes its main job.
And that must completely redefine the idea of freedom.
Radically. Freedom is no longer about having secure access to the means of life, you know, food, shelter, a stable job.
Instead, freedom becomes freedom from.
Freedom from interference with your monetary accumulation.
Which is why regulations that are designed to protect, say, the environment or workers, are immediately framed as an attack on liberty.
Exactly. The whole legal question flips. When a corporation's activity harms the environment, the court rarely asks, is this undermining the conditions for life?
The question becomes,
is this damage legally priced? Or is the fine less than the profit? It's a calculation.
And public institutions.
Yeah.
Things that should be our foundational life support systems. They seem especially vulnerable to this logic.
They are. Public health, education, social care. They get reframed structurally as just expenditures, not as foundational investments that reproduce our ability to live.
So if a public school or a hospital can't show a clear, measurable return on investment, a cash ROI,
it's immediately labeled unsustainable, wasteful, too expensive.
Mm.
It completely ignores the fact that these institutions are what sustain life itself, which is the only real form of wealth there is.
So these systemic failures, they're not random. They're just the system working as designed, but on the wrong design.
Precisely. They are the inevitable result of putting monetary flow ahead of the integrity of life.
Okay, so this analysis has been, well, it's been pretty diagnostic. It shows us the flaw in the code.
Mm-hmm.
But the source isn't just saying we should, you know, abolish markets or property entirely.
Yeah.
It seems to be making a more constructive argument.
It is. The goal isn't to dismantle the tools. It's to restore life as the governing standard, to re-embed markets and property back within their proper ethical limits.
So how do we do that?
We have to revive and modernize those original Lockean provisos. Take modern sufficiency. Restoring that principle means property arrangements must actively ensure everyone has universal access to basic life requirements.
Food, water, housing, healthcare.
The essentials. And when markets clearly fail to provide those for everybody, public intervention isn't some infringement on property rights.
It's the fulfillment of property's original moral purpose.
It's the fulfillment. That reframing is profound. It makes public action a moral duty that's inherent in the very structure of property, not just some optional charity.
Okay, what about waste?
So modern non-waste has to expand way beyond just rotting apples. Today, it has to include systemic ecological destruction. It has to include planned obsolescence, which is just a massive waste of materials and labor.
And maybe even the burnout of human beings.
And the burnout and exhaustion of human labor, especially when there's so much unmet social need. An economy that degrades its own life ground is, by definition, a morally wasteful economy.
And the third one, the use-value constraint, seems to take aim at those purely abstract claims that the money exception created.
It does. It means ownership has to be constrained by its actual contribution to life or to a social function. So purely speculative claims, like hoarding massive amounts of housing just for passive investment while people are homeless, or gambling on commodity futures that are totally detached from production, those things lose their moral privilege. They lose their legal protection.
The policy implications of this are, they're huge.
Oh, they're radical.
When you reverse the money exception, for example, taxation doesn't look like a penalty on success anymore.
No. Taxes become the necessary mechanism for reclaiming value that was abstracted away from the life support system in the first place.
And public investment.
Becomes a necessary replenishment of that life ground. And ecological policy shifts completely. Planetary boundaries like climate stability or clean water, they're reframed as absolute moral boundaries that you simply cannot cross.
So profitability has to operate within those limits.
Rigorously within them, not as something that gets to decide whether the limits matter.
The choice, then, seems really simple, but also brutal. We either have a value system that treats life as an expendable cost input,
or we have one that recognizes life as the ultimate ground of all wealth and prosperity. When money is put back in its box, back in its instrumental role, serving life, not governing it, then ethical limits become intrinsic design constraints again.
So to wrap this all up, this deep dive has really shown us that the crises we're facing are, at their core, a kind of moral design flaw.
Mm-hmm.
The money exception. It's this one move that silently flipped the ultimate standard of value in our economy centuries ago. And restoring any kind of stability or justice means we have to flip it back.
Right. And if you connect this to the bigger picture, the source gives us a really clear explanation for why our systems keep failing. Crises happen precisely when we expect institutions built entirely on the money sequence, the flow of profit, to deliver life sequence outcomes like public health or ecological security.
So it's not that they're failing at their job.
It's that they are succeeding perfectly, but according to the wrong structural logic. Their purpose is misaligned with our needs.
It really makes you rethink every single calculation of cost in business and in government today. So we'll leave you with this final provocative thought to consider.
Mm-hmm.
If life is the fundamental condition of all value, then what is one commonly accepted cost in your own field? Maybe it's an environmental externality, a labor sacrifice, an accepted failure rate in healthcare. That should, by definition, completely non-negotiable, because it actively undermines the capacity for life.
And just consider how redefining that one single element would change your perspective on the entire system that you work in.
Thank you for joining us as we explored this profound exception and the possibility of restoring a life-grounded economy.
Until the next deep dive, keep questioning the standards by which value is truly measured.